You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Afternoon, you're listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and I am back. I hope you've enjoyed this summer of phone interviews and in advance interviews. I'm back in town for the foreseeable future and interviewing folks who come through Spokane. So if you missed it this weekend, the local Unitarian Universalist Church hosted a whole weekend of talks and workshops and events with Rabbi Michael Davis, and he is a rabbi based in Chicago who kind of shares his story about becoming a fairly active Palestine solidarity activist. It's a topic and region that I like to revisit, and it seems like a good time to be kind of highlighting what he has to say, highlighting some of the voices of other folks locally and otherwise on this topic. So I'm going to share that interview with you. I also have some really exciting stuff coming later this month to kind of close out the summer. I spent a good chunk of the weekend at the Veterans for Peace National Convention, which was here. If you didn't catch it, they brought some really amazing anti-war activists, indigenous nonviolence activists, all kinds of folks together. They set up a huge Arlington Memorial in Riverfront Park, and they just brought together a ton of national voices here in town. So I recorded some interviews there, and I'm planning to share those over the next couple weeks as well, and all kinds of other things. So if you have ideas for folks you think I should interview heading into the fall, you can always email me, Praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, at KYRS.org. I'm always happy to hear those suggestions. You can message the page on Facebook or on Instagram at Praxis Radio. And those are the best ways to reach me. So again, if you missed the talks, A Journey for Justice at the UU this weekend, I guess here's your chance to hear what Rabbi Michael Davis had to say. And if you miss any part of the end of the show and you want to catch it, it will be posted on the podcast later this evening, which you can find links to all the major platforms at kyrs.org/show/praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S. So without further ado, here is that interview recorded just this past Thursday with Rabbi Michael Davis. All right. Thank you so much for joining me on the air today, Rabbi Davis. I'm hoping you can start by just introducing yourself, talking a little bit about who you are, your story, and what people might expect if they're coming out to any of your talk or events this weekend.
Great. Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me on your show. I'm Rabbi Michael Davis. I live in Chicago, in a suburb of Chicago. I'm the rabbi of Congregation Makom Shalom in the Lakeview area of Chicago. And I'm coming to Spokane this weekend to teach about Palestine solidarity from a Jewish perspective, to tell my story. And I'll be the guest of the Unitarian Universalist Church. I'll have three or four events from Friday through Sunday.
So just to start, for folks who maybe are less familiar with Israel and Palestine, or who have a vague familiarity, they might be surprised, I think, seeing the visuals on this flyer for the event with the two flag hands shaking hands, and even just with you as a rabbi, as a leader, leading this discussion, if people aren't familiar with Jewish Voice for Peace, etc. So if you could just talk a little bit maybe about your journey to how you ended up where you are, being such a staunch supporter of Palestinian human rights.
Sure, and I understand that people may have that perception, since the mainstream sort of Jewish organized perspective is standing with Israel and muting the criticism, you know, such as there is, and not standing so clearly with the Palestinians, although I am part of a growing movement of fellow Jews and rabbis, tens of thousands of Jews and 20, 30 rabbis I can count who share a similar perspective. I was born in England, as you can probably tell from my accent, and we moved when I was a child to Israel out of belief in the Zionist ideology, the belief that Jews should live in Israel, and Jews who live outside Israel are not living a full Jewish life. And now that there is a state of Israel since 1948, this is accessible. So why wouldn't a Jewish person want to live that full Jewish expression that's available in the sovereign Jewish state in the ancestral land of Israel? So I grew up in Israel, junior high, high school. I served 3 years in the Israeli army, went to college there. And over time, I began to move away from the ideology I perceived in school. And it was actually quite a strong right-wing ideology to the right of many other Israeli Jews. And I began moving away from that, ultimately reaching the point where, when in my late 20s, I was contemplating where to begin my sort of grown-upping, my adulting life. I didn't want to do that in Israel, and I turned to the United States. And over the years of being here, I've been here for over 20 years, I've moved further to the left and to being sort of a outspoken advocate for Palestinian solidarity as an expression of my Jewish values, as an expression of my American values, my adopted homeland, and just as a human being, this is the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. And looking at your experiences growing up, being in Israel, looking from your bio, probably like the late 80s, early 90s, did coming to the U.S. and learning this other perspective, did it put some of those experiences in a new light for you? Did it cause you to look back and reflect on some of those earlier like childhood experiences in a different way?
Well, no, that's a great question, right? So like revisiting those parts of our lives as grown-ups, right? That's part of the work of sifting through what ideas that have been planted in my head are ones that I still want to hold on to now. And certainly that has been a lot of the personal work of working through this. And in fact, when I went back to Israel to visit family over the years, I made it the point to stay in places that were outside the Jewish milieu, so I could sort of see Israel a little bit from the outside, looking in from the outside of the Jewish Israel. So I stayed in a bed and breakfast in a convent and a village just outside Jerusalem so that I could sort of see Israel from without. And definitely I have revisited things. And one of the insights that I've been fortunate to gain over the years is to see what I wasn't seeing when I was in Israel. So when I was living in Israel, I would see the abandoned Palestinian villages, those that were destroyed in 1948 during the Palestinian Nakba. You can see the empty shells of the buildings, the trees growing out of these old Arab stone buildings, these abandoned villages, the rubble underneath forests and so on. The evidence was there, the ghosts of the Palestinians who were kicked out or not allowed to return during that Israeli War of Independence / Nakba. That was there to see, but I didn't see it with the full import of what it meant. I didn't have the political context or the understanding or the affinities to move beyond the particular viewpoint that I'd received. And that is something that I've gained since leaving and having that space and distance here in America to revisit what I saw with my eyes but didn't really see with my heart.
And then in addition, over that same period of time, things have escalated in such a way and intensified on the ground, even in a disastrous way, even just in the last couple of weeks in Jerusalem. So I guess I would assume that that intensification has probably also played a role in this change in your perspective as well.
When I left Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu was just rising to power. The consensus among my friends, well, first of all, we didn't know how he got elected because nobody I knew had voted for him, right? Which might have resonances for America today. So in some ways, the process Israel went through is kind of foreshadows Trump era here, the rise of the strong man, the rise of an ideology that the country only belongs to the white European, colonialists or immigrants, the suspension of rights, the sense of the sea change. And so a lot of that, so we went through that. And so when Netanyahu rose to power, it was very much, this can't be happening. This guy's an empty suit, and what he does say is scary. And little did I realize when I left in 1998 that 21 years later he would still be very much in power. It's just remarkable that he's, aside from a few years, he's been prime minister pretty much all this time, and just intensified the ideology, as you said. The process that I sort of saw the beginnings of when I was leaving has really, unfortunately, come to fruition now, and that was, I grew up in a section of Israeli Jewish society which was called the modern Orthodox, the religious nationalist, might all call them the messianic political Jews, those who led the colonization of the West Bank after the 1967 Nakba, out of a heated theology that believed that the West Bank was indeed part of the ancient biblical Israel, and until that was claimed colonized by Israeli Jews and Israeli sovereignty was imposed on it, then the messianic dream that is the state of Israel wouldn't have fulfilled its mission. And I was part of that movement. And what I was seeing when I was leaving was the very beginning of those young leaders beginning to rise through the ranks of the Israeli military. So they were beginning to occupy the elite sort of combat units, commanding those, which was unprecedented. And that really is the track that many political leaders in Israel take to rise to power. They start out in these crack units, rise through the ranks, and then however rank they leave the military, that is the springboard to a power within civil society. So the generals go to lead political parties and head mass corporations, and the colonels have other positions of power and so on. So beginning to see the numbers of these officers rise, way disproportionate to their number in the population. I thought, well, that means 10, 20 years from now, they're going to be in positions of leadership. And that is actually what has happened. The head of police, the head of the Internal Security Service, key ministers in government, other institutions are headed by my peers who still hold that ideology, that sort of heated nationalistic, religious nationalism.
And do you
think so in that sense, it's gotten worse. And of course, the reality on the ground for the Palestinians has gotten much, much worse, as we know.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that pipeline of military leadership into political leadership is more normalized in a country like Israel that has universal conscription into the military, or do you think that that is still jarring for people in Israel?
In Israel?
Mm-hmm.
Jarring to be honest. I mean, it's considered normal in Israel. You know, army officers are the darlings of society. You know, they are, it turns into a very macho society, right? Because it's the men who get to be in the combat units. So that sets the rest of society up to be dominated by men too. So there's the misogyny that's implied in that too. I don't know to what extent people find it jarring. I mean, I have family, two nieces who refuse to serve in the military, and I gave them my full blessing. So there are people who withdraw from the system, but the mainstream is certainly, this is okay, this is great, this works fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and something else I'm really curious about between Israel and the U.S., as someone who's worked on this issue and done Palestine solidarity work in the past, there's been a major crackdown intellectually in the U.S. around expressing solidarity for Palestine, whether through BDS or otherwise, dissent of U.S. military support to Israel. It's become a lot more formal and a lot more intense. And I've found that folks I know who express the same kinds of dissent and solidarity within Israel or the West Bank or even in Europe don't experience that same level of attack against expressing that opinion. So I'm wondering what you think about this crackdown in the U.S. and how it might compare to folks' expression within Israel.
Right. Well, I mean, famously, right, Israel has this sort of raucous political culture. So you have somebody like Gideon Levy, who writes, you know, the most outspoken denunciations of the Israeli military and occupation. And he is a member of the editorial board of one of Israel's leading newspapers. So in some senses, there are key dissidents who have a platform, at the same in Israel, which you don't see here. At the same time, the force of the state is so much more powerful in Israel, and you know, there's no constitution. You know, as you know, most likely from your friends, international solidarity activists are sometimes barred at the airport. I've seen undercover cops intercept young people as they come off the plane before they even make it to passport control when I've gone to visit Israel, and all sorts of violations of rights, and there's no recourse as there is here. So, and it's Israel's issue, right? We debate immigration here perhaps, you know, vigorously because it's a domestic issue, whereas Israel is not such a domestic issue. Although it's turning into a domestic issue because of the crackdown here, and that I agree. In my home state of Illinois, the Illinois House of Representatives voted to bar companies that endorse BDS, which is the Palestinian Call for Solidarity, the call for equality between Israelis and Palestinians. If you endorse that call, then the state of Illinois will not do business with you. And that passed the House of Representatives 102-0. And across the state, similar laws are being passed in House of Representatives. And that leading up to the, on the federal level, you know, Senate Bill number one, the first order of business of the new Senate was banning BDS, you know, pushing hard against the First Amendment. And there's House Resolution 146, which is on the House side of things. So on the federal level, we're moving towards the criminalization of free speech on Israel. And it's becoming, Israel is becoming a domestic issue in America. So yes, I'm concerned about the stifling of free speech here, despite the Constitution, although we do have some safeguards here that Israel doesn't have.
Yeah, and it feels like it ramped up rather quickly, this criminalization and censorship of support for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS. And I'm wondering if we can get into the basis of that criminalization, which is the idea that criticizing Israel and expressing solidarity with Palestine is somehow inherently anti-Semitic, which is obviously not true, if only because there are so many Jewish people, both in Jewish Voice for Peace and outside of, who support these movements. But also, how do we acknowledge that anti-Semitism is real, and it's alive and well in this country, and it's resurgent, and it's something that people who care about human rights are also concerned about. How can we begin to kind of unbraid those threads, separate being against Zionism and the State of Israel's policy versus being anti-Semitic? I don't know. I guess I'm hoping you can lend us all some guidance on how we can begin to untangle that process.
Yeah, maybe I can talk a little bit about it. It is very odd. So first of all, how did we get here, and then what can we do, right? Mm-hmm. You know, in May 1948, when the State of Israel was established, the founder of the State of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, corresponded with a fellow Zionist in the United States in Hebrew. And it's a wonderful exchange because it illuminates Israel's thinking through the mind of its founder, and he was a brilliant thinker. And in this correspondence, David Ben-Gurion writes that as of May 14th, 1948, when he declared the State of Israel, the word Israel no longer means the people Israel as it has meant since the Bible. The word Israel now means the state of Israel. And anybody who Jew who lives outside Israel is not quite Israel, not quite the full Jew. They can come to Israel, and they should move to Israel, and then they can become part of this new Israel. But otherwise, they are not. So this is the succinct way of talking how Israel became Judaism. And not only in Israel, but increasingly in the American Jewish community, there's been this identification of Zionism equals Judaism. Most synagogues have an Israeli flag next to the Holy Ark as part of the liturgical symbols. Some sing the Israeli national anthem as liturgy. The word Israel is used in liturgy in ways that are ambiguous, that could leave people thinking that we're talking about allegiance to the state of Israel rather than the original meaning of the word. So there's been this colonization of the concept of Israel as meaning the state of Israel, and Zionism equal Judaism, to the point where to attack Israel is to attack the Jews, and therefore it's anti-Semitic. There is criticism of Israel that is anti-Semitic, right? There are anti-Semitic forces about Israel, but that's not what we're talking about, right? The leaders of the BDS movement, Omar Barghouti, has gone out of his way repeatedly to denounce anti-Semitism. And so the majority of those claims are baseless. And certainly the claim that to attack the state of Israel is inherently anti-Semitic is obviously ridiculous. I mean, I'm a rabbi and I attack Israel in these terms. So you have to say that I'm anti-Semitic, which is just doesn't make any sense. So me and my colleagues.
It's a very bold claim.
But the idea, but it's made and it's used to justify these laws, right, that are shutting down, trying to shut down Palestinian solidarity. So it has currency, and we have to work to dispel that, as we're doing right now. People make those claims and feel they're true. I would actually make the opposite argument, because the idea that Israel is now the new Judaism is the same argument that Jews used to attack Christianity. Because Christianity presented itself as the new Israel, supplanting the old Israel. And in theological circles, this argument is called supersessionism, that Christianity supersedes Judaism. And this has been a major complaint of mainstream Judaism against Christianity, arguing that Christianity has been anti-Semitic for saying that Jews have no right to occupy that term anymore. And I would argue that the state of Israel is doing the exact same thing with traditional Judaism by claiming that political Zionism, the idea that Jews have to have a nation state in the ancestral land of Israel, that's the only form of Judaism. That is a form of supersessionism. And we see that may sound like a strong statement, but we see that playing out in reality when Prime Minister Netanyahu makes common cause with Viktor Orban, the leader of Hungary, who's out anti-Semite. When Richard Spencer, the white supremacist in America, speaks of the state of Israel as his inspiration. If the Jews in Israel can have their own state, why can't the whites in America have their own state? So I would argue that Zionism, as we see it today, is a perversion of Judaism. And we shouldn't tolerate the notion that they speak for Judaism. And in fact, it's getting in the way of us having meaningful conversations about the racism and anti-Semitism that is rising in America, as you referenced in your question, which I'm very concerned about, particularly, the white supremacists, and particularly the white supremacists who are fueled by Christianity. We are not having the hard conversations we should be having about the latent anti-Semitism that still exists in Christianity and even liberal churches, the texts from the New Testament that are upheld as liturgy. All those conversations we're not having because whenever the question of anti-Semitism comes up, if the alleged anti-Semite can show their pro-Israel credentials, they're given a free pass. So Israel becomes a way of shutting down the conversation about the real threats to real Jews in America today.
Well, yes. And as someone who works on and has interviewed a lot of people about white nationalism in this country, which is an anti-Semitic movement, and it's a movement that threatens all of us, and I think it's the looming most important threat to to us in this country, I think it's only strategic that we be able to work together against that, you know, against that looming threat.
Right. And the white nationalists who hate the Jews will typically hate a whole lot of other people, too. So we're already natural allies. Mm-hmm. And we should get away anything that gets in the way of that. I agree. I think the mainstream Jewish community is doing more of that, but certainly the organization I'm affiliated with, Jewish Voice for Peace, is really mindful about building alliances with other groups. We're all in this together.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and if you're just joining us on the show, I'll let you know you're listening to Praxis here on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. I'm talking with Rabbi Michael Davis. He is going to be here in Spokane talking in a few different engagements. If you're listening to the podcast this coming weekend, if you're listening to the live show on Monday, you just missed it, but you'll get to hear this interview, and there's some more resources we'll share at the end. He'll be giving a talk Friday evening, August 16th, Saturday evening, a discussion in two parts on August 17th, and then both Sunday morning services on Sunday. So, Michael, I'm hoping you can share with us, what can folks who are planning to go to any of these events expect? And also, what have you learned? What have you got for yourself out of having these conversations in faith spaces, different faith spaces, and your own?
So, it's something I used to do more of. I'm blessed with young children, so I do less of it than I used to. So I'm really excited to be coming to Spokane, and have been really warmly welcomed by everybody I've spoken to by phone or by email these past few weeks in preparing for the weekend. Pastor Todd Eckloff at the church, at the Unitarian Universalist Church, I've spoken to a local rabbi and others. So really connecting with people has been really wonderful. I've spoken in various venues. I spoke at McGill University in Montreal, churches across the United States, public libraries. I spoke last December at the Milwaukee Rotary Club. They'd had the Israeli ambassador to the United States speak there on Derma, and I was invited to give the rebuttal. So I've spoken about this in various contexts. And usually people bring me rather than a Palestinian, because they say it's hard for people sometimes to hear the Palestinian point of view. And as Palestinians would say, we would like you to come rather than one of us, because they'll hear it better from you, which is unfortunate, but if that's the ask, I'm happy to show up and do that. I think a lot of people are hit with the anti-Semitic arguments that oppose Israel as anti-Semitism, and having a rabbi speak about this is helpful, hopefully, to people to unpack that. You asked about what I'm going to talk about. So the Friday night talk is me telling some of my story with Zionism and my journey, actually starting before I was born with my grandparents, and conveying some information through that. And my goal is to share one story, my story, but the parts of my story, the different chapters, I think are shared with many others. And the story in its entirety is a story that perhaps isn't heard as much as others, and one that's being silenced through criminal legislation, through social shunning. And just to allow that story to be heard in public, I'm hoping will allow others who are listening to explore their own story and to push against those subliminal and explicit messages that tell them that it's not okay to hold these thoughts and to engage with these values and commitments. So that's what I'm hoping to accomplish with the Friday night talk, and to hopefully it'll be interesting to people to hear stories and to hear the political events as they impacted me personally, and I was present at some of these historic events. So I'm hoping it will be interesting and engaging for people in that way. On Saturday, we're doing a talk and then a workshop on anti-Semitism, because this is the question that comes up, as you raised it too. It's very present to people. And to sort of unpack a little bit what is real anti-Semitism and what is fake anti-Semitism. And for people to go a little deeper and explore their own feelings of racism, because, you know, we all carry unreflected thoughts, and to create sort of a safer environment to do that, and there'll be some agreements around the space and with regard to each other, so that hopefully people will be able to connect with what they hold inside themselves and to reflect on that together. On Sunday morning, my talk will be a vision for what the future could hold for Israel-Palestine. And the framing is one law for Jews and non-Jews, for Israelis and Palestinians, coming out of a Jewish religious perspective. In the Torah, we call it Torah Achat, one law. In the United States, we call it the liberty and justice for all. And the argument is, what would that look like to bring that to Israel-Palestine and transform the relationships there on the granular level, on the political level, to hold the vision of a just peace and a future, a safe future for all the people who live there.
It sounds like I have to rearrange my weekend now to come. So
great. Love to see you there. Yeah. And all your listeners.
Yes, and I will make sure to post those links and the flyers for the event and everything in the podcast notes, which you can find just by scrolling down wherever you're listening to this, or at kyrs.org/show/praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S. So I want to loop back to something that you said when you were talking about one law. I know that a lot of folks can be intimidated learning about Israel and Palestine and all of the complexity. People sometimes like to act like you need to know every bit about history, all of the granular detail of what happened when and who did what to whom, and it intimidates a lot of people against engaging. So maybe for folks who aren't deep in this issue, can you talk a little bit about the ways in which Israel of today does not have one law for all people, and kind of demystify that for our listeners?
Right. Sure, but can I just touch on this thing of being intimidated by the details and not knowing enough history?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's it almost feels to me that there's an insidious intent here, because I hear the argument a lot, like, you can't talk about this because you haven't visited, you don't know this detail, you don't know that detail. And I've encountered this for many years now, that somehow there's some level of education on the topic that you must attain before you're allowed to hold an opinion on it. Mm-hmm. I know a lot. I live there. I study this intently. But I'm sure there are people out there. I know there are people out there who know more than I do. So should I defer to them and say, I have no right to an opinion? I mean, I think in a democracy, issues which are of burning importance to people, you go and vote no matter what your level of education is, right? That's the foundation of democracy. You have a right to your values and your opinion, and everybody gets to vote. And if this is a matter that affects the United States, and it certainly does, we're complicit, we fund it, it's affecting our freedom of speech here, then we all have a right to an opinion, and we have to trust that we can speak on the level of values, and we don't need to get caught up in the details. So I would cut through all that and say, there's no level of education that you need to wait for before you can say, this is wrong, you know, this doesn't work, we need something else. So I would encourage people to push back against those arguments, as I do when people bring it up, and they do bring it up the whole time. Mm-hmm. We don't say that about voting here. We shouldn't say that about any world issue. Yes. I don't know enough about climate change. I don't know enough about this. I don't, but I can still have an opinion, and we should act. Mm-hmm. Regarding what ways Israel is not, doesn't have equality, so there are over 20 laws in Israel that explicitly give rights to people who are registered at the National Population Registry as Jew, and not given to those who are registered in the National Population Registry as non-Jew. So the state of Israel keeps a registry of who is a Jew, who is a not Jew, and that religious category determines what laws apply to you.
Mm-hmm. Regardless,
you can be an Israeli citizen, but if you're a non-Jew, you don't get those rights. The most blatant one, which affects people beyond citizenship, is the law of return, so-called law of return, that if you're Jewish, and if you're not Jewish, you could convert to Judaism, and they get on a plane and land in Israel and be given money and a citizenship and all sorts of goodies just because your religious category is Jew, whereas a Palestinian Israeli who lives there wouldn't get the same package. And a Palestinian living outside Israel wouldn't be able to come back. I wouldn't be able to even enter the country with ease, and certainly wouldn't be able to come back and claim citizenship. So the religious category determines citizenship and determines access to legal rights. And that, of course, translates into much bigger systems of, social systems, who can live where, who has access to power. For instance, the Arab political parties, the Palestinian political parties in Israel, Israeli citizens, educated people. One is led by a doctor, Obi Gaini. You know, they have no access to power. They've never held ministerial position. The new Israeli party, the Blue-White Party, led by Gantz, Benny Gantz, former head of the Israeli military, he had to promise not to share power with Arabs, Israelis, Israeli citizens who are Palestinian, in order to get launched as a major Israeli party. So there's a social compact among Israeli Jews that Arabs will not have access to power. So those are two ways in which the discrimination works, one on a legal level and one in just the way the political structure works. And as you said earlier, if the road to power runs through the military and Palestinians don't serve in the military, that's another way in which they are blocked from moving forward in society and gaining positions of influence.
Mm-hmm. And so what I always tend to hear when I'm having this conversation with folks who are, you know, strongly in support of, you know, like a Zionist platform, they'll say that, you know, this Jewish majority needs to be engineered because otherwise Israel will be wiped, you know, clean. And I'm wondering from your position, you know, theologically, historically, that threat feels to me from the outside that it has been part of the story of Judaism, of persecution and everything. So how does that history feed this narrative, and how do you theologically move past that fear-based, you know, drive to something new, to something that looks like liberation and one law, like you said?
Well, I mean, it's true that, you know, just in the last century, right, Jewish people suffered the Holocaust, mm-hmm. this irrational hatred. You know, Hitler on his deathbed, you know, repeated his, genocidal anti-Semitism as his last will and testament. So it's this irrational insanity in this land that took the lives of many, including my family. So it's bound in reality, this fear. But it's also used to justify things which, you know, which are not justifiable. And, you know, one of the arguments is that we need the state of Israel to guarantee the safety of Jews. But I've got to tell you, having grown up and lived in Israel and living here in the United States, I feel much safer as a Jew in the United States than I did in Israel. So I don't quite understand the argument that the state of Israel guarantees the safety of Jews. You know, the argument that if things, you know, God forbid, went south in the United States, then Israel would be the place of refuge. But the reality is that the state of Israel is kept afloat by the United States, militarily, diplomatically, financially. And if any of those supports were removed, Israel would collapse or be in dire straits. So, you know, in some ways, the United States is the canary in the mine for the state of Israel. And if things went bad here, there wouldn't be a state of Israel to go to. So there's this ideological reversal that Israel is not the frontier. Israel is not the newest Jewish community, the newer Jewish community of the two compared to the United States. Israel is not the periphery, all of those which are true. And instead, the ideology that Israel is the center subverts that and says that Israel is the center and Jews outside Israel are the so-called diaspora, even though most of those Jews have never lived in Israel, so they can't be a diaspora. Israel is the place of refuge and we're unsafe here. Those are ideologically informed statements that don't reflect the lived reality of people right now in Israel and here. So, and then in terms of Israel has to maintain its majority in order to maintain control, that's actually, there's a dark side to that, because the notion that if Israel has 50% Jews plus one baby, they get to run everything, mm-hmm. including all these laws and so on. And that's not quite what we mean when we say democracy in the United States. Jeff Halper, who's an activist in Israel, a lot of great work, he has this theory that the founders, the intellectual founders of the Jewish state of Israel from Eastern Europe, weren't informed by Western ideas of democracy like France or England or America. They came from the Russian sphere. And in Russia, Russia is dominated by the Rus tribe. And this one tribe becomes all of Russia, and all the other minorities don't have the same access to power as everybody else does in Russia. It's the idea of the winner takes all. So if you have that majority, that 50% plus the one Jewish child, then you win the whole pot. And there's no constitution to guarantee the rights of the minority. So the premise that we need a Jewish majority to maintain the status quo is one that I find repugnant. And I also find that since the United States is the one enabling this crazy state of affairs in Israel, then why wouldn't the United States step up and create a different reality, which may be just as untenable or more tenable, but certainly might have a better chance of being just and guaranteeing the rights of the minority? And finally, you know, you ask, how do we move from fear to love or from fearfulness to justice? It's a lot more fun to live with a forward-looking perspective of what we, the world we might want to live in and what we might want our children to live into, rather than carrying these fears, some of which are real, and perceived fears, and these, you know, manipulations which count on subjugating another people in order to thrive. That's not a fun way to live.
That's a really good argument that I don't hear very often, is that it's not fun. I think I'm going to have to keep that for the future.
Activism is fun, no? It's a lot of fun. You get to talk about your values, you get to envision a world, you get to meet like-minded people who are moving things forward. It beats sitting around saying how miserable we are, you know?
Yeah. We have to amplify that a little bit, because I think a lot of people think that it does consist of sitting around talking about how miserable we are, but that is increasingly just daily life for folks in this country. So, yeah. Is there anything else that you want to share with folks that I haven't asked you about yet?
Well, I want to encourage folks to connect to their values and to proudly state how they feel about Israel-Palestine, and to not feel silenced by whatever Jewish friends they may have who call them up or Facebook, you know, message them and say, this is anti-Semitic. I think that, you know, the state of Israel is not a Jewish story. It is also a Jewish story, but the Holy Land is holy to Muslims and Christians. It's one of the reasons why it occupies so much of our attention. And it's a human story, which I think is perhaps the Unitarian Universalist perspective. It belongs to everybody, and certainly belongs to American taxpayers because of how much, the billions of dollars that we send there each year to sustain the status quo. So it's not cool for those of my co-religionists who disagree to say, you who are not Jewish don't have a right to your opinion, and if you insist on it, I'm going to label you an anti-Semite. I want to encourage people to resist that, to say, these are our values, we have a right to our opinion, I value your friendship, but if the price of that friendship is I have to give up my values, then you're not a true friend. So to stand up boldly and speak up to that. My Israeli friends are pleading me and my fellow activists to act more boldly here to save them from the situation that they're caught up in Israel. So that would be my parting thoughts. to not fall back and say, well, it's too complicated, or, well, maybe it is anti-Semitic, you know, all those doubts. No, it's quite clear who's the powerful, who's the weak, what is the just side, what is the unjust side. There are many other issues in the world, arguably some are more important, but if this is your passion, if this is where you have a chance to speak out, then I'd say don't be held back by those who have an interest in silencing us.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you so much for your time and for the work that you do, and we look forward to seeing you this weekend in Spokane. And for people who can't be there, if they want to connect with the work you do, with any writing or anything like that, where would you send them for further resources?
Well, I would send them to Jewish Voice for Peace, jewishvoiceforpeace.org, if I remember correctly. There's a wealth of resources there. That's the organization I work with. You can find lots of people there. I'm actually, as we're talking, I'm typing it up to make sure I'm giving you the right. Yeah, jewishvoiceforpeace.org. There's a wealth of resources there, and fellow rabbis and so on. And absolutely.
Great. Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be coming to Spokane this weekend. Thank you.
Good.
All right. If you're just joining me here on the show, at the end of the hour here, that was an interview I recorded this past Thursday with Rabbi Michael Davis, who spent this past weekend at the Unitarian Universalist Church in town speaking with that congregation and the public. So I figured better late than never to share it. He is not in town this coming weekend. He has just left. But hopefully, you know, you enjoyed that interview and that this is a longer term conversation going on in our community. It's certainly a longer term conversation going on right now. I interviewed him in the morning on Thursday before the announcement regarding Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar came down that Israel would be denying them entry into the country due to their past and current support of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. It's kind of exactly what Rabbi Davis and I were talking about in the interview. And I guess it just really points out that this censorship around this issue is real from the White House right now. And it also, I just constantly want to try to amplify anyone and remind myself about this idea that he talked about in the interview, that it's not anti-Semitic to criticize Israel. There are anti-Semitic ways to criticize Israel, and we need to be savvy about finding those and pointing those out. But for Donald Trump, who has supported verbally other folks who are overtly anti-Semitic, who are part of white nationalist movements and white supremacist movements, which are, of course, inherently anti-Semitic, and really put those tropes out into the world, to then turn around and say that these two congresswomen are so anti-Jewish, as he said, and anti-Israel, to say that they're disgraceful, etc., and to ban them from, well, to support them being banned from visiting a military ally as elected leaders of the country is a really dangerous precedent and something that I think people should pay attention to. So again, if you missed any part of that interview and you'd like to catch the beginning, I will be putting it up on the podcast in just a couple hours here. You can find that by going to kyrs.org/show/praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S. You can also find links and all of the rest on social media, either on Facebook or Instagram at Praxis Radio, P-R-A-X-I-S-R-A-D-I-O. And you can email me as well if you have ideas for shows, comments about shows, people you really wish you could hear from on the show. You can email me at praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, at K-Y-R-S veteranspotlight.org. And like I said, I'll be back next week and the week after that with some of those great interviews from the Veterans for Peace National Convention this weekend and more to come beyond that. So thank you so much for listening. And you're listening to KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio.